evening. This is Dr. Stan here at Radio Liberty, coming to you from the hills overlooking beautiful and picturesque Monterey Bay and bringing you the story behind the story, the news behind the news, hoping to convince you that reality is usually scoffed at and illusion is usually king. But in the battle for survival of Western civilization, it's going to be reality and not illusion or delusion that's going to determine just what the future will bring. Now, I need to remind you that the views that are expressed here are not those of the owners, management, staff, sponsors, or supporters of this station. They're my views, the views of our guests, the views of our callers. And if you have any question or comment, don't hesitate to give us a call. You know our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. And we always love to hear from you, but right now we hope we're going to have a very, very special guest coming on the line, Dr. Garth Nicholson. And those of you who don't know who Dr. Garth is, Dr. Nicholson was a biologist, a professor at the MB Anderson Cancer Clinic. He held three professorships at three different universities. He has only over 400 peer-reviewed papers published in the United States. And then, of course, he made the mistake of stumbling onto the fact that some of the men coming back from the Gulf War, or many of the men coming back from the Gulf War, were infected. About half of them were infected with a mycoplasmin. So, Dr. Nicholson, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Thank you so very much for coming on to Radio Liberty with us this evening. And I already sort of introduced you and gave your background. And now you've left the MB Anderson Clinic and you're residing in Southern California?
That's correct.
I see. And you have some sort of a biological research organization that you're going to be working with there?
We founded a new nonprofit research institute called the Institute for Molecular Medicine in Irvine, California.
All right, fine. Well, we'll certainly want to talk about your work on the Gulf War, but I noticed that Len Horwitz, Dr. Horwitz, has written a book, Emerging Viruses, and I noticed that on the back of that book you have a letter saying that you felt this was a very good book. And, of course, Len Horwitz is a good friend. We've had him on as a guest on a number of occasions. What's your impression of his analysis of the ability that scientists had to actually genetically engineer the HIV virus?
Well, it's certainly a possibility, and although it hasn't been proven, I think it's a possibility that needs to be looked at very carefully.
It's amazing, then, what the scientists can actually do to take a virus and change its molecular structure or its chemical structure. How do they go about doing things like that?
Well, essentially, we're talking about creating new viruses by splicing different genes together to create different types of hybrid genes and hybrid viruses and new organisms that way. And in fact, now with the techniques of molecular biology, it's completely possible to create new species of life that way.
Really, this is an amazing thing. Now, what you have found, is this a relatively new type of organism, what you found in the Gulf War veterans, something about a part of the HIV virus or the shell? Well, what actually did you find?
Well, what we found was a very unusual type of microorganism called a mycoplasma. There are about 30 known mycoplasmas, but the one that we found in the patients with Gulf War illness is a fairly rare type of a microorganism. And we found an unusual gene in this microorganism, or associated with it. That gene was one of the genes from the HIV-1 virus, the envelope gene, but none of the other genes of the HIV-1 virus. So it's not that the microorganism was infected by the virus in any way. That we doubt if that can really happen. But what seems to have taken place is that somehow a gene was either transferred or picked up by this microorganism, and in doing that, I think it created a very pathogenic strain or substrain of this mycoplasma, because the gene that's associated with it is a gene that can allow this mycoplasma now to travel in the body and enter cells. Most mycoplasmas do not enter cells, but there are a few that do, And this one we think may have been modified so that it would colonize a variety of different tissues to make it more pathogenic and more lethal.
No, ordinarily mycoplasma are not that invasive, are they?
That's correct. They're not invasive, and normally they're not systemic or system-wide. And we've hypothesized that this gene, the envelope gene, may have turned this mycoplasma from an organism that primarily would colonize a single organ, for example, like the lungs or the
sure.
urinary tract, and made it systemic, or made it capable of going throughout the body and entering a variety of different tissues and cells.
Now, is this like the GP, like the glycoproteins that's on the shell or the envelope of the HIV virus?
The envelope gene encodes a molecule called GP120, which is
okay.
a glycoprotein. It's on the coat of the virus, and
right.
this is the glycoprotein that attaches to receptors on the cell and allows the HIV virus to enter cells. So the mycoplasma is probably getting in through the same mechanism that the HIV-1 virus uses to enter cells.
Okay, fine. So that helps me to understand. I'm an orthopedic surgeon. Of course, orthopedists don't know much about virology other than what we learn from people like you. Well, how did you happen to get interested in studying the Gulf War veterans?
Well, we got involved in this when our stepdaughter came back from Desert Storm, and she slowly came down with a series of chronic signs and symptoms that were not easily explainable. And it turns out there are between 80 and 100,000 veterans that have these unusual collections of signs and symptoms which defy the normal diagnosis categories that the military or the VA uses to describe illness. And this, of course, has created a terrible problem because many of these people have unknown diagnoses as their main problem, or they get pushed into psychiatric diagnoses, which is very common, post-traumatic stress disorder and some of these other stress diagnoses. And we don't think that that is accurate. And most of the veterans, as a matter of fact, almost all the veterans that we've talked to are particularly disdainful of having this type of treatment. Most of the people that we've worked with are officers, some of them up to very high level, up to a two-star general, and they are very, very disdainful of the way that they're being treated because they have Gulf War illness.
All right. Find out, does this mycoplasm cross the blood-brain barrier?
Yes, it can.
It actually can get in then to the central nervous system.
Yes, it can. And in fact, one of the interesting things about this mycoplasma is its propensity to colonize the peripheral and central nervous system. And again, we feel that the HIV envelope may be important for this process to occur. Once it is located in the peripheral and central nervous system, it creates all kinds of havoc, both in modifying the metabolism of the nerve cells, but also it slowly proliferates, and when it's released from these cells, it can take a piece of the plasma membrane with it. And when that happens, it can set up an autoimmune type response, and often the patients, when they progress, show very unusual autoimmune symptoms very similar to ALS, MS, lupus, and so on. And these rare autoimmune diseases involving the central and peripheral nervous system are not treatable. You just can't find a simple treatment to cure these patients. Yet the patients that have these autoimmune symptoms respond very well to certain antibiotics that are effective against mycoplasmas, and the signs and symptoms are alleviated slowly but surely by these treatments. So we don't think these members of the armed forces that served and their family members really had those autoimmune disorders. We think that the autoimmune aspect of that was established because of the mycoplasmal infection, and that's why we could alleviate their signs and symptoms with certain antibiotics.
And they developed then the typical neurological findings you find with ALS or with multiple sclerosis. What about MRIs? Do you find any patchy demineralization there, either in the brain or the spinal cord?
There are some differences in MRIs, and this has been reported. The differences are often very subtle, and it really only occurs when the disease is well progressed. So these are not things that crop up early on in the illness. These are signs and symptoms that occur later on in the disease process.
Okay, fine. Now, as you've been working with this, you commented that you believe that this may be a man-made mycoplasm or a genetically engineered mycoplasm?
Well, we can only hypothesize on that, but we have our suspicions because of the nature of this mycoplasm and the fact that it does have this HIV-1 envelope gene, but none of the other genes of the HIV virus associated with it, that it may have been modified for use as a biologic weapon.
All right, fine. Now, ordinarily then, the mycoplasm and its fermentus, this ordinarily would not have that envelope gene then. The one that, you know, I would have, or the average individual, if they had this mycoplasm infection. In other words, this is an entirely different type of organism than existed before.
Well, you know, that's very hard to prove unequivocally, but we think that the variant that we find in the soldiers may be a new strain. There are a few strains of Mycoplasma fermentans, and this would be the incognita strain, is the one that we found that has the HIV virus. We haven't really carefully examined, mainly because we really don't have access to it, the earliest strains of the M. fermentans.
All right, fine. Now, you've actually taken care of, or at least you've done blood tests on a fairly significant number of veterans?
Well, we reported at the last American Academy of Environmental Medicine meeting our results on 170 veterans and their family members, and of these, a little under half had the presence of the mycoplasmal infection in their blood. And I think that's the important thing. We're dealing with a systemic infection. We're not measuring these mycoplasma from oral samples or sputum. We're measuring it in the blood. Whenever you get an infection like this, like a mycoplasma, that you can detect in the blood, that's a fairly sure sign that it's a systemic infection. And so that's primarily what we do. We've got two different assays that we can use now, the gene tracking, and we've modified a forensic polymerase chain reaction that we can now use as well to back that up. So we're pretty confident in the data that we have. Some other laboratories are now just beginning to do this. There's a laboratory in Beverly Hills, a commercial lab, and we've consulted with them, and they've modified their assays, and they're able now to detect this mycoplasma in blood samples, and they weren't before because they were throwing out the DNA fraction that actually contained the mycoplasmal DNA. So it's a little bit tricky. And this may be why some of the government laboratories that are struggling with these assays haven't been able to duplicate our results, but that's understandable with something new like this.
All right, fine. Now, basically, are the veterans infecting their wives and wives infecting their children? Is this going through the entire family?
Well, we have some families of which every member of the family, one by one, came down with the signs and symptoms of Gulf War illness. It doesn't happen to everyone, but 2 years ago, the Senate Banking and Housing Committee did a survey of over 4,000 veterans, and they found that 77% of the spouses and 65% of the children were exhibiting some of the signs and symptoms of Gulf War illness. So we have found in our own families that we followed the one by one members of the family come down with it. Usually the spouses are the first. They're usually 6 months to 18 months out after the veteran returned home, and then the children are often after that. So it requires probably some prolonged contact, so we're not dealing with a highly contagious microorganism, but these are airborne pathogens, so they do pass eventually. And there's a fairly long latency for the appearance of signs and symptoms, so it does take some time before the illness actually shows up.
Well, of course, you know, that's one of the terrible things about HIV disease, is it has this terribly long latency period, and, you know, it's such a long time before people get sick after HIV infection. Do you think it has to do with the GP120 you talk about? Why does it have such a long latency period? Because what the, you know, the government keeps saying is, well, look, you know, back in 1970, 1992, and 1993, we didn't have that many people who were ill. It seems that more and more people keep coming down all the time.
Well, I think part of it is that it's a very slow-growing microorganism,
right.
And I think it very slowly colonizes various tissues. And for this reason, it just takes a long time for the clinical signs and symptoms to become evident.
But the doxycycline really seems to be quite beneficial.
Well, doxycycline can be used. you have to treat a patient for a prolonged period of time with it because, again, we're dealing with very slow-growing microorganisms that are buried deep inside the cells. So there's both a problem of pharmacokinetics of getting the drug to the location where it's necessary and maintaining it at high enough concentration to do good, and also the fact that the mycoplasmas are fairly slow-growing and fairly resistant to most drugs. So things like, certain antibiotics just don't affect it at all. And some antibiotics that work on bacteria that have cell walls, like penicillins, actually make the situation worse. So one of the things that patients who are never allergic to penicillin, who have Gulf War illness, they have terrible adverse reactions when they take penicillin.
Okay, fine. Now, I've been reading in the paper that the government, I guess the Army, has said that they're going to investigate your claims. Have you been contacted? Do you think they're really going to seriously look into this, or is this going to be more of the same?
Well, it looks like they are going to look into it. I was back at Walter Reed Army Medical Center just before Christmas, called by Major General Leslie Berger, mainly at the instigation of Representative Norman Dix from Washington. He has been very interested in this, and he holds a very key position on the Armed Services Appropriation Committee in the House, so they listened to him, in contrast to some of the other committees that are going through hearings right now on the Gulf War. The Pentagon really does listen to this committee because they hold the purse strings over the military. And they immediately organized a meeting, and we have another meeting scheduled later this month, and I'm supposed to go back to Walter Reed to try and implement some of this.
And, of course, you can then show them how to do the studies.
Well, I'm going to try and get some laboratories, which are non-government laboratories, which would be independent of our massive biologic weapons program, to enter into this. One of the major problems that we have in this country is that, you know, it's very hard sometimes to find, an institution that doesn't have conflict of interest, that isn't engaged in biological weapons development.
Well, now, how can we be engaged in biological weapons development? That's against the law, at least.
That's correct. It is against the law, but this has gone on essentially unimpeded since the law was passed in 69, supposedly stopping this type of work. The United States is also signatory to international agreements in 1972, which was supposed to stop biologic weapons development, proliferation and transfer. But I don't think that stopped our government from continuing on this program. And this is one of the reasons, I think, why we were so severely attacked, is that they were afraid that this would uncover this massive program and the extent that it's infiltrated into the university and educational system in our country.
Well, now, were they actually doing biological warfare research back in Houston, where you were?
Yes, they were. I really can't go into that in any detail, but the answer is yes, and in a very prominent way. And it's one of the reasons why I left the University of Texas system. I was being put under tremendous pressure because the government was essentially putting pressure on the institution where I was at, even though I was a tenured and endowed professor, endowed chair, they were still putting a tremendous amount of pressure on the institution. And this is not in isolation, by the way. Anybody, it seems, who have come out against biological weapons development has been put under tremendous pressure. Anybody that's spoken out on the way our veterans are being treated has been put under tremendous pressure. Some of the VA physicians who actually spoke in the same session that I was in at the American Academy for Environmental Medicine in Boston at the end of October, had their jobs threatened. As a matter of fact, they tried to fire. Matter of fact, all of us that were on this one program at one time or another have been threatened with termination because of our work on Gulf War illness.
In other words, if you try to bring out the truth, the fact that our veterans are ill and not getting treated, then the people who try to tell the truth come under pressure. That's very disheartening. In fact, it's almost enough to cause you to be totally disillusioned with the way things are going.
Well, it is kind of disillusioning to think, you know, you're trying to do the right thing, you're trying to help people, and then the government feels so threatened by that that they'll pull out, any stop they can to try and stop you or even eliminate you. We've had threats against our lives, and some of them very credible. to the point where some of our friends in the special forces have interceded to help us.
Well, I just hope the Lord protects you, because I really appreciate, and I know our listeners and people all across the country appreciate the work you've done. Our telephone number here, 464-8295, or 1-888-24-LIBERTY, if you have a question for Dr. Nicholson, who's certainly out in the forefront of this whole incredible effort. Now, how many of our veterans have died? Do you have any idea at all?
Well, we could only estimate, because they're keeping these figures under lock and key, but we did have somebody in the VA Central Command slip us some data in 1994, which at that time there were approximately 7,000 deaths due to the veterans of the Desert Storm. Now, this is from all causes. Now, recently, there were a couple of papers in the New England Journal of Medicine which indicated that these veterans were not dying at higher rates than their brethren. In fact, there are a couple of physicians and myself who are writing a rebuttal to these papers, because they were very narrow in their scope. They only looked at either military or VA hospitals. And we know from working with the families, and particularly veterans that have died, in fact, none of the veterans that we know that have died in military hospitals. They all died at home or in private hospitals. And so right away, you know, you have to question, you know, if that data is complete and if it's accurate. Most of these died without diagnoses, official diagnoses. So the cause of death, if you look at the death certificates, the cause of deaths are either unknown or attributed to the immediate cause of death without, you know, any investigation to the underlying causes of it.
So, what sort of things would they die of? I mean, would they be renal failure or hepatic failure or central nervous system? What sort of things would
they die of? Well, they die of all sorts of things. But, in fact, one of one of the categories which was way out of that whack was accidents. They're dying at a much higher rate of accidents. And we, you know, can speculate that some of this may be due to the fact that they have attention deficit, they have short-term memory loss, they have coordination problems as their diseases progress. So some people become partially paralyzed or even completely paralyzed. So, you know, it's not out of the question, particularly if you have problems with your eyesight, because that deteriorates, that people would die of accidents at a higher rate. You know, they denied that there were any heart problems in the veterans, yet over and over again we've seen veterans that have had dramatic coronary problems. I'll give you an example of one young veteran who we work with recently. He was an Army veteran. He had, at age 24, a massive a heart attack, MI. He was in the University of Michigan intensive care unit. When his family contacted us, and we got involved in this because they sent his records, and his records indicate that he had a progressive disease, that it wasn't just a sudden heart attack, and it wasn't simply heart disease, that he had a variety of some 40 signs and symptoms, which were synonymous, as we know, with Gulf War illness. So it's obvious that he had a systemic disorder. He was waiting in intensive care for a heart transplant. So they had scheduled him for a heart transplant, and they were trying to find a match. We found out that he was infected with this mycoplasmal infection. We recommended they put him on intravenous doxycycline, which after some hesitation, finally agreed. They put him on the antibiotic. He did recover, and a few months ago he went back to work without a new heart. His heart function by cardiogram increased from less than 20% to almost 80%. So he doesn't have a complete new heart, but it's certainly a lot better than it was, and I don't think he needed a heart transplant. He needed to eliminate this infection from his system.
Well, now, of course, this infection would be present in blood transfusions, wouldn't it?
It should in the leukocytes. That's where we detect it in our blood tests. So if someone is symptomatic, yes, I think that this infection will be in the blood.
And, of course, since nobody recognizes it, they're not even testing for this.
No, they're not. We actually had a telephone call from somebody in the American Red Cross, and they indicated to us that no, it's not a matter that they're not testing, and that they claim that they reject anyone who shows any signs and symptoms of illness from donating blood. Well, I hope that's true. I know a lot of blood is donated each year by the military, and I don't know whether that they're as careful with those military donors as the other people.
But you'd think that they would, you know, if this, knowing what you know, you would certainly reject any Gulf War veteran from giving blood, wouldn't you?
Well, as a matter of fact, right after the Gulf War, the Pentagon, because of the Surgeon General of the Army, put a hold on donating blood, and that hold was in place for at least 6 months. And then I think it was extended to a year after Desert Storm, but then I guess there was too much pressure on the military to donate blood because the American Red Cross receives quite a large amount of blood from the military. So that ban was overturned, and they started, again, donating blood.
Okay, we've got Jeanette on the line. Hi, Jeanette, how are you doing?
Hi, Dr. Stan, I'm doing fine.
A question for a comment for Dr. Nicholson?
Yeah, I heard, I was listening to our Santa Cruz radio station early this afternoon, and Dag had on his program a man by the name of John Strasser. I think that's his name. I think he's a columnist or a news person or something. I unfortunately, I've forgotten. But he was talking, his guest was talking about junk science, and I felt angry because he grouped the studies done on the Gulf War syndrome in the junk science category.
Well, what do you expect on Dag's program?
Well,
Dag is an establishment conservative, and you ought to know better than to listen to it. I was just
curious because I heard about the topic. You're the second person who said that to me today, Dr. Stan. But one comment this man did say, and Chris, you were laughing and chuckling.
Oh, sure, these crazy nuts who think there's a Gulf War syndrome.
Yes.
And that's what they use. They just sort of use this ridicule for anybody who thinks there's a problem out there.
Yeah. Well, this John Strasser or whoever was saying, well, the troops who did not hear about these symptoms are not ill. And, of course, those who heard about these symptoms are ill.
Well, that's just hogwash, frankly.
Yeah. Exactly.
We've worked with some of the most elite units in the armed forces, Navy SEALs, Special Forces, airborne units. Mm-hmm. These are the most elite units that we have. We've worked a lot with officers all the way up to a two-star general.
Mm-hmm.
These are not laggards. These are not people that are prone to hysteria or susceptible to stress. These are hardcore professionals, the most professionals that we have in the armed services. And these people were coming down with this. They were very stoic. Most of them weren't admitting to military hospitals or military physicians, you know, the exact details of their illness. They only really came to us as a means of last resort to get help. We've tried to maintain their anonymous state, more or less, so that they wouldn't be retaliated against in their own services. We've helped a number of these people recover, and that's kind of how our name got around. It didn't get around through the news media. It got around through mostly the military officers and their friends. And so this went on for years before the media ever knew anything about it.
Yeah. Well, you know what upset me? I was upset because he was attempting to discredit what I felt, to discredit your work, but also look at our armed force people and their families that he's hurting also. These people are suffering. And they're laughing at this calling it junk science, and that was, I think, so disheartening.
Well, you ought to know, you know, that you just these are the standard techniques they use.
Yes.
They use ridicule. They use all these concepts to discredit anybody who's trying to tell the truth. Mm-hmm. And of course, you just consider the source.
Yeah, that's true. But I was sorry to hear that, and I'm really glad to hear you this evening.
Okay, thanks so much, Jeanette.
Okay, bye-bye.
We're basically, I've interviewed Candy. I won't give her last name, but she was with the Graves burial unit that was there working in, I guess, southern Iraq right after. And you know that case, don't you, a young lady?
Yes, I know that I know that woman quite well because we've tried to help her with her problems, which are several fold. I mean, she's got a lot of different problems, and one of the difficulties that she has is she does have this infection. So we've been trying to help her with that aspect of it and deal with that.
But all the rest of the people in that unit are dead.
Apparently so. It's difficult to get a confirmation on that, but she heard that from her military lawyer that the other members of her unit, at least 14 out of 16 members of her unit, were now dead. This was a unit from the 24th Mechanized Infantry Division, and they were on Graves registration duty, or Graves registry duty. They were mostly bearing Iraqi soldiers.
Right.
And it's quite possible that they...
It sounded almost as if those people that she was bearing, you know, had chemical, you know, they didn't seem to be wounded, but a lot of them were bleeding from their mouth and bleeding from their nose. Her description, you know, just literally hundreds and perhaps thousands of Iraqis, they were just pushing into the large ditches. And really frightening the whole thing. Now, where do you think that chemical warfare fits into this whole thing, or is this sort of a something to throw us off the track?
No, I don't think it is. No, I think it's a very important element of it, and I think some of the soldiers have as their principal problem exposure and damage due to chemical weapons and other chemicals that they encountered in this highly polluted battlefield, and then some soldiers got both. I think they were exposed to both chemicals and biologic agents, and those are probably the ones that are sickest because the chemicals have suppressed their immunity and the biologicals have just gone wild.
Well, now, the problem that, as I look at this whole thing, I've heard that some of the people, some of our soldiers who have come down ill, never got to Desert Storm. It was just that they had the vaccines. Is that true?
Or that's true. There are some cases where soldiers were vaccinated and they had adverse reactions to the vaccines and ultimately came down with what looks to be a Gulf War illness type of syndrome. And those, we think they may have gotten contaminated vaccines, and those vaccines could have been contaminated with some similar microorganisms to the ones that we're dealing with.
Well, have you found those who did not actually go to the Gulf, any of those have had the mycoplasma?
So far, we haven't really looked.
Okay.
Because we haven't, you know, a lot of the patients and their physicians come to us, they contact us, they make arrangements for free blood testing and counseling, you know, part of it depends on who's referred to us.
Okay, fine. So now, is there anything that can be done for the veterans that, you know, got some sort of a toxic reaction from the gases? Is there anything they can be done for them?
Well, the treatment of chemically exposed veterans, in some respects, is not as straightforward as these infections. Although the infections are difficult to treat and require prolonged therapy with antibiotics, the exposure to some of the chemicals requires a different type of approach, and mainly that's an approach that environmental physicians use, which is trying to isolate an individual from chemical pollutants of all sorts and then trying to rid the body of any residual chemicals, and hopefully the damage that's occurred will slowly repair.
Okay, fine. Now, as far as the young men who have this infection, how long does it take on average before it begins to get them? In other words, is it a year, 2 years? Most of these fellows come down within 3 years, or we're, what, 6 years now since the Gulf War. Are some of them still coming down with it?
Well, we do have some cases that are apparently still coming down, and we're not sure if that's because of proximity to soldiers that were sick, and so they've gotten it because of infections essentially that were not in the Gulf War, and that's how we think the families have come down with it, because the families trail the veterans by 6 to 18 months. In terms of their clinical signs and symptoms becoming very apparent. So wherever you have barracks and wherever you have people posted together, when you have an airborne pathogen, then there is the risk that can spread. So in talking to soldiers who are posted in Bosnia, for example, in those units that have a very high proportion of veterans of Desert Storm, they're seeing Gulf War illness at much higher rates than in other units that have very few members that served in Desert Storm.
But isn't this having a terrible debilitating effect on our military? You know, if it's going through the military, active duty military, these people aren't going to be able to perform their duties, military duties.
Well, generally what they do is they force people out before it gets to that point. There, a lot of personnel have been forced out of the military, And, you know, part of it is that people voluntarily leave because they're ill and they can't perform at the expected level. But the other thing is that when they are sick, they're being forced out. And it's particularly true of the officer corps. Once they're sick, and particularly if they register, there is a feeling that they're being forced out, that they're being told that they're going to be passed over for promotion. And so it's a dead end for them, and it's time to leave.
Well, now, do the patients have an elevated white count? Do they have an elevated set rate? Is there anything other than the symptoms that they have? And then, of course, the very highly technical testing that you're doing.
Most of the blood workups are relatively normal. There is an increased level of natural killer or NK function. In some patients, there have been abnormal levels of IgG. Some patients have altered ratios of CD4, CD8, which is synonymous with immunosuppression.
Right.
You know, so in some cases there are some blood abnormalities, and usually these don't occur until the patient is really quite symptomatic.
Well, you know, this whole thing is really so frightening because, of course, if this isn't recognized, these people continue to be sick. You know, they're going to be getting it into the general community as well.
Well, we're seeing it now for the first time in the general community. We didn't see it before when years ago when we started doing this, but now we're kind of picking it up. We're you know, talking to people who have become sick with chronic fatigue syndrome and so on, and even testing some of those people. We're finding it in the population. We're particularly finding it in people that travel to the Middle East, oil field workers, businessmen that go back and forth. So I think we're going to see increases in this. We've contacted physicians in the Middle East, and they have major problems in Kuwait, northern Saudi Arabia, Jordan. Now it's estimated that 15% to 20% of the entire populations of those countries are sick with Gulf War illness.
That, of course, is a frightening thing to contemplate, because if it's that much there, how much will it be here, 10, 15 years from now?
Well, we're going to see it increase, in particular because of this denial of our government. And just like you heard, they're trying to put out the disinformation, calling what we're doing junk science. I find that amusing. I have over 430 publications. I'm an editor of two journals, and I serve on 10 editorial boards, and nobody's ever called the science that I've done junk science.
Well, I know, but you see, the tragic thing is that they'll go after anybody who dares to go against the establishment, and that's what you've done. What about the Presidential Commission? Apparently their report was just brought out yesterday. Were you able to talk to them at all or get any information to the Presidential Commission?
Well, I testified twice to the President's panel, and of course they received a lot of testimony from a lot of different physicians and scientists. I kind of wonder if any of that was absorbed, because in their final report they really don't have anything to say. And they really don't have any recommendations on how to approach it except do more research. So, I don't know if they were asleep at the wheel or what, but very little actually came out of all that deliberation.
Right. I know there were some people on it who felt, you know, they were very, very critical of the government covering up things. But I would think that if you'd had a chance to talk to them and present your material, I would think that at least would have been mentioned in the report, unless, and I know what happened when they had the AIDS Commission report under President Reagan, and that was, they brought in a new chief of that committee, and he just eliminated a lot of the really important things when the report was written up. Do you think that could be what happened, or was the committee itself so slanted and biased in its makeup that you weren't going to be able to get a fair hearing?
Well, we haven't seen the final report, so I can't comment on exclusion of anything. The committee was slanted towards the people who were either in the military or had done work for the military or whatever. There were very few people on the panel who did not have some ties, either active or in the past, with the military.
Well, now, what about other countries? What about Great Britain? What about Czechoslovakia and these other countries? Are they having trouble there with their military as well?
Yes, they are. They're having Gulf War illness in the group of Czechs that went down. Most of these, as you recall, were in chemical detection units, and they actually got quite a bit of publicity in a way, because they were detecting chemicals, and when the United States was trying to cover it up, they were, you know, broadcasting that they'd had chemical detections. They were probably some of the most sophisticated equipment in theater. In Britain, they have a major problem, and we've been consulting with some of the veterans groups over there. They're doing exactly like the United States and trying to stonewall it, pretend it didn't happen, cover it up. In Egypt, they have a major problem. We've addressed in Cairo the Egyptian military. In Pakistan, there's a problem. We've sent information. In fact, one of our colleagues is in Pakistan right now, speaking to government officials on this. Basically, every country practically that served has had some problems, except the French. Now, it's interesting that the French army, of course, they were out on the flank, so they were far away from most of the actual action. But the French, they administered doxycycline prophylactically to their soldiers, and they don't seem to have the problem with Gulf War illness.
Well, why would they have done that unless they knew what was coming? In other words, this must have been something that was released on the battlefield.
Well, they knew what was coming because we knew what was coming. In fact...
Well, please get into that, because I think that is really maybe the crux of this whole discussion.
Well, let me just give a couple of comments from... Colonel Gerald Schumacher. He's a battalion commander of the 91st Chemical Battalion at Fort Baker in California. His unit had the only available real-time biologic detection system that was available to our military. So the units under his command could have been deployed and used to detect biologic weapons in the Persian Gulf. He requested three times to deploy his battalion and its units to the Persian Gulf, and three times Lieutenant General Harrington refused his request to deploy his unit to the Persian Gulf. And he said rhetorically on the American Investigator, which is a show on KNET out of Washington, D.C., that were they afraid that our detectors would go off too much? He actually said that as a rhetorical question on the show and in full uniform. So I think he's probably having his problems now. But they were really not very candid with any of us about the hazards going into that conflict or what they might face.
Now, right now, we hear all these rumors that, you know, there were some people who knew that this was a genetically engineered organism and that we'd sent it over to Iraq and perhaps to use against the Iranians or the Kurds or something of the sort, and we knew that this organism might be used. Is there any truth to that, do you think?
Well, we're not sure. We think that it may have been shipped to the Iraqis during the Iranian conflict. That's for sure. And in fact, we've heard that there is some evidence for this, but we haven't seen it ourselves. We know that either the same organism or a very similar organism with modified genes was tested in the prison system in Texas before the Gulf War. And some of the prisoners died, and some of the guards became sick, and their family members became sick, and environmental physicians have certified those sick families as having Gulf War illness from before the Gulf War, and they actually, we got involved in this in testing them, and they did respond to the very same antibiotics that the soldiers respond to, and most of these have now recovered.
Okay, and now actually then, you think that perhaps the French had advanced knowledge of what was going on, and that's why they gave their troops the antibiotics ahead of time?
We think that they knew exactly what we knew, because they were part of the coalition forces, and the intelligence was supposed to be integrated. So I think they had the same information that we had.
But then why didn't we give our troops that to protect our troops? And that, of course, is the $64,000 question.
Well, it's very interesting that you bring that up, because we had a letter, in fact, I still have it in my files, from a generic drug company in the United States called Zenith Pharmaceuticals. This company received an emergency order for doxycycline 2 weeks before Desert Storm, the ground offensive in Desert Storm. They had to deliver something like 18 million units to an Air Force base immediately. So they were working 24 hours a day to package these things up and get them ready. They were taken to an Air Force base, and the last thing they saw is they were put on a pallet, shoved into an Air Force transport plane, and shipped to the Persian Gulf. Now we switch back to a little bit after the war, and some of the soldiers who were getting rid of some of the remnants of equipment and supplies that were left behind. One of these soldiers had as his duty to bury these pallets, and he managed to save one of the packages in it before they were buried in the sand, and sure enough, it was a package of doxycycline.
But why didn't they give it to our troops? I mean,
I don't know. It doesn't make sense to me. I think the reason they probably didn't is because there were few immediate casualties. They somehow thought that there would be more immediate casualties, and when they didn't see them, there were only 148 KIAs or killed in action during the ground offensive. They assumed that there wasn't a problem, even though they had all these chemical alarms going off, and they should have realized that if over 14,000 chemical alarms go off, that we potentially have major problem on our hands. They just sort of put their head in the sand and hoped that it would go away. It didn't.
Well, of course, when this whole story eventually comes out, you know, I think the American people, the American military, you know, there's going to be such a furor out there that a lot of heads are going to roll. But what I'm afraid of, you know, is that maybe somebody will resign, or Colin Powell will resign, or, you know, I don't know, but they'll just say, oh, well, shucks, it's just such a terrible tragedy. We're sorry. In fact, this whole debacle as far as the chemicals, you know, and they denied for almost five and a half years there were any chemicals, and then 1,000, 2,000, 5,000, 20,000 exposed, and then all of the records have just mysteriously disappeared. You know, it's just, the records go up to a certain point, and then suddenly there's a big gap in all the records that would deal with, the chemical alarms going off. Somebody is covering up.
Well, that's a conclusion that you have to come to. I mean, we've talked to fairly high-level officers, for example, in the Marine Corps, when they had positive detections of nerve agents in western Kuwait, and they were using the Fox vehicles, which were the most sophisticated mass spectroscopy real-time detection systems that are available in the world. They could analyze some 300 different chemical agents in those vehicles, and they were getting positive detection and confirmed with another Fox vehicle of lethal chemical agents, nerve agents. And when this lieutenant colonel who was in charge of these vehicles sent his information forward to Marine Division headquarters, he found out later on that the logs had been altered or disappeared.
It gives you sort of a spooky feeling, doesn't it?
It does. I mean, when the original tapes from these detections disappear, when the logs are altered or when the logs disappear, it really smacks like they're trying to hide something.
Right. Our telephone number, 464-8295 or 1-888-24-LIBERTY. If you're out there in the listening audience and you have a question or comment for Dr. Nicholson, and certainly there's nobody that I know in the country who can give you more information on this terrible, terrible tragedy than our special guest this evening. Well, is there is there any thing that at this point we can do to try to get the information out? Is there anything we could do to help you bring pressure to bear on the government to you know, they're going to have another panel, and it'll be another simple cover up, and even Congress itself, most of these committees are sort of whitewashes, aren't they?
Well, unfortunately, many of them are, although I think the more we publicize this, the more pressure that's put on and the more people are aware of what's happening, I think, and the more they're informed about it, the less likely the government will be able to push this off as junk science or fantasy, or somebody made all this up, or these people aren't sick and they're not dying and their families aren't sick. This is the myth that's been perpetuated, and it's been perpetuated because of a very small number of people at the top of our military and at the top of our civilian hierarchy in the Pentagon. And I don't think that we should protect these people, or that they need protection on the backs of hundreds of or over 100,000 of our young men and women.
Now, I've heard that the fatality rate in England is pretty high. I just don't know if that's true or not. Somebody was said they had, 50,000 troops, and do you have any idea how many have died over in England?
I don't have any exact figures on that. I've also heard that the death rate is running higher than than expected and higher than comparable death rates in the civilian population, but I don't have the figures.
Okay, fine. Let's go to Dudley here. Hi, Dudley.
Hi, how are you?
I'm doing fine. Did you have a question or comment?
Yes, I had a question. I noticed that your guest was saying that some people were sick and then they were cured. So the question was, are you able to have a treatment that would cure most of these people, do you think?
Well, I'm not sure that we've ever cured anybody of these illnesses. The reason is as follows. We can treat them and they can recover. Often they relapse, so they require several cycles of treatment. And after they get through a half a dozen cycles or so of treatment, generally if they relapse, it's milder and milder. But these microorganisms are buried deep inside the cells, and you have to think of it almost like TB, tuberculosis. Is that once you're infected with this, you may never get rid of it. You may recover and be able to lead a normal life, but you may never, ever get rid of some residual amount of this. When we do our detection, when people recover, we don't see it in their blood any longer, but that doesn't mean very much because very little of it's in their blood in the first place. Only some spillover is probably in their blood, and most of it's deep in their tissues. And very hard to get at and very hard to determine if it's gone or still there.
And can it really colonize almost any tissue? I mean, you described this gentleman, you know, who was being considered for a heart transplant, so this actually must have colonized in the heart.
Yes, it does colonize the heart and virtually any type of tissue. This can get in. There's certain tissues it seems to favor, like synovial tissues, for example, in the joints, and this causes a lot of joint pain and loss of mobility in an arthritic condition. It does colonize peripheral and even eventually central nerves. It colonizes all the major organs. This has actually been documented on autopsies.
Okay. Anything else, Dudley?
I'm wondering, this particular drug or something that you give them, do you have to have a lot of different drugs, or is there one universal one that seems to work?
Well, we have four or five different antibiotics that we found to be effective, first one being doxycycline, second one being ciprofloxacin, a third one that we can use for pediatric cases as well as azithromycin, and then clarithromycin is the last one, or Biaxin is the last one that we've been using. Sometimes these are used together, sometimes they're used sequentially. If there's apparent resistance, that is, the patient is no longer responding to a given antibiotic, we can switch to one of the other antibiotics. And this is fairly commonly used in treating chronic conditions. You have to sometimes switch because the slow-growing nature of these microorganisms means that they might acquire resistance to the antibiotics.
The other quick question is, how many of the Gulf War veterans do you think are coming down with this disease or symptoms?
Well, we're not quite sure of the Gulf War veterans. The estimates are that there are between 80 to over 100,000 of them that are sick with this now, and it's of course much higher if you start to count their family members who are sick. So we're not quite sure of the numbers because, as I mentioned before, some officers and other highly professional members of the armed forces aren't even on the registries because they do not feel comfortable in reporting that they're ill because they're afraid that this will hurt their career.
Thank you.
Okay, fine. Thanks so much, Dudley. And let's go to Dr. Barry. Hi, Doctor.
Well, good evening, and thank you so much, gentlemen, for being on the air with this fascinating dilemma here. Dr. Nixon, I'm a family practice doctor here, but I've also am trained in epidemiology, and I'm curious, I know that one reason that you were able to demonstrate this was because of your wife Nancy's work in cellular biology or the gene tracking, gene dismantling methods that you're using that apparently, as I understand it, weren't available to the Defense Department. I wonder if you could amplify on that and why the Defense Department isn't discovering this. And is there any way that we have of tracking the spread of this disease in our population?
Well, my wife Nancy, who's actually would have been on this program, but she's out of town right now, did develop the gene tracking technique that we use. It's not the only technique that we use. We use forensic PCR as well in the detection of these microorganisms. And yes, these techniques were not available to the Defense Department, particularly the Armed Forces Institute of Pathology. They've kind of insisted on still using antibody techniques to trace this, but we're not very enamored with those techniques because these microorganisms are deep inside the cells, and using the antibody techniques is not very effective against these tissue-penetrating microorganisms because they're not really exposed very much to the immune system. Furthermore, those techniques are they're just not very sensitive. So we have tried to develop more of molecular biology type approaches to detect these infections, and I think we'll be seeing more of this in the future. But basically, I don't think the armed forces wanted to find these things, so that's one of the reasons they didn't really seek us out early on and ask for help.
Well, do you think that possibly they knew what it was, or somebody knew what this was, and really didn't want to get this information out, because this is going to be tremendously incriminating towards the people who developed this organism if the information ever gets out?
Well, it's again, I can only hypothesize on this, but I will state that I do feel, or I strongly suspect, that certain individuals knew all about this, and they knew all along what was going to happen, and they just, to protect themselves or to protect the United States or whatever, they chose to remain silent and enter into this cover-up.
You know, one of the things we hear, they have these special types of new tomatoes or various and sundry things, these genetically engineered products, maybe bacteria that'll keep frost from hurting tomatoes, things of that sort. And everybody's screaming, what happens if this gets loose and it does harm? But, if we're experimenting on bacteria for bacteriological warfare purposes, and one of these things got loose in society, the impact would just be devastating.
Well, unfortunately, I think some of these things have gotten loose, and some of them may have even been open-air tested in our society. Without going into great detail about this, there are clusters of illness very similar to the one I've just described in certain areas, and it's very suspicious. There's no smoking gun yet, but I think if these are investigated much more thoroughly and not as casually as the CDC has investigated them, that I think they might actually find something like that.
Dr. Nicholson, I'm aware of your letter to JAMA. Are there any other literature projects you're working on or sources in the literature that we can point our colleagues to learn more about this organism?
We have four additional peer-reviewed papers in environmental medicine journals, and in fact we're preparing another one now for a more general journal. The environmental medical journals have picked up on this very quickly, and that's why we publish there. But if you write to me, I'll be glad to send you copies.
Okay. Can you stay with us just for a few minutes into the next hour?
Sure.
Okay, fine. We're going to have to... Barry, you're welcome to hang on if you'd like to, but right now we're going to have to remind our listeners that this is Radio Liberty, and of course we look to you for continued support. Our address, Post Office Box 13 in Santa Cruz, 95063, and of course our address, pardon me, our telephone number, 1-800-5-HIV-WARM.